The following is intended solely for the use of those with a sense of adventure.
I'm shaking the dust of this town off my feet, and I'm going to see the world.
This is Travel with Hawkeye. Here's your host, Mark Hawkeye Lewis.
I know that you know that I'm very excited about the podcast, because I always am excited, but Deborah Winger is here today. Yes, Deborah Winger. You know her from Urban Cowboy, Terms of Endearment, Officer and Gentleman, Academy Award nominated actress, took a little hiatus, has a movie out called The Lovers. We have a few moments to talk with her. I heard that she's a very big travel enthusiast, and it's great that she's acting again. She's also in The Ranch on Netflix, so you can check her out there. We're going to talk to her in just a few minutes. Also on the podcast, we have Ed Rush. He's a pilot for EAA, which is, it started out as experimental aircrafts, an association of those folks, but it's kind of expanded, and they actually have restored also a number of classic historic airplanes, including the Ford Trimotor. And I got a chance to ride on the Ford Trimotor. What's interesting about this and its aspects connected to travels, this basically was the very first passenger airplane, the first time they ever used an airplane to get passengers from point A to point B. Before that, had been used for mail, been used for military purposes, for use just for people learning how to fly, and it was the early days of aviation. No one really had thought at the beginning to use it for passengers. This was the first time they used it. So they've restored this plane. It was built in 1926, and it travels the country now, and got a chance to fly in it. In fact, if you go to our Travel with Hawkeye website, click on blog, and we've got pictures and videos up there of this plane, and it's called the Tin Goose. It looks almost like an Airstream with wings. And the inside is decked out for passengers. And Ed is one of the pilots. He's going to tell us about the early days of commercial aviation. Or not commercial aviation, but passenger aviation. But it's kind of interesting to note on a day that we're talking about that, just how much it has changed for passengers in my lifetime. Because I remember one of the first times I ever flew, I was in the third grade going to the fourth grade. And my dad was stationed overseas, and we flew from Turkey, where he was stationed, to New York City. I think we had a stop in London. So, but I remember specifically getting on the plane in London, going to JFK Airport in New York City, and dressing up as someone who was 8 or 9 at the time in my Easter best. I mean, I wore my little blazer that I only wore on Easter and Christmas, with my tie that I only wore on Easter and Christmas, and I think my school picture also. And my brother wore the same. We wore coat and tie, which was very odd for, you know, a 9-year-old. And then, you know, I had two sisters, and they were also dressed in their Easter dresses, and my mom and dad were dressed very elegantly, because that's how, and we're not flying first class. We were just flying coach, or whatever it was called at the time. But that's how you got dressed up to fly. It was a totally different experience. People got really dressed up to fly. You wore your very, very best clothes. And nowadays, I mean, I literally see people getting on a plane in their pajamas with a pillow. I mean, it has totally converted to comfort first, which is not a bad thing. I mean, you know, especially if you're a parent, I can't imagine how much fun that was for my mom and dad to dress everybody up. But we were so excited to get on an airplane. It was such an amazing experience at the time, because, you know, you just didn't fly that much. We drove everywhere when we were in the United States, basically. So it was very exciting to get on the plane. But I just can't imagine, you know, my parents getting everybody dressed up and to get on the plane. It's kind of interesting, though, to note, one, we've become a very casual society, and that's mirrored in how we travel, but also how traveling has become this arduous experience. I mean, it's almost like getting on a bus now. You got to line up, you know, by your group. You're getting yelled at a lot of times by flight attendants. I mean, you've all seen the stories in the past few months about flight attendants and kicking people off because they had a cake and they didn't store it properly, even though they told them the first time they needed to store it properly. Or, you know, of course, the United Airlines flight where they drug someone off the plane. I mean, that's just horrible. Even United Airlines admitted that was horrible. And it's just, you know, the lack of leg room, the lack of amenities. It's totally changed. I still love going to the airport. The airport's my happy place. When I'm going to the airport, I know I'm going to end up somewhere fantastic. I'm going on a trip somewhere. So I love going to the airport. But and I like the flight, because to me it's a chance to unplug and just kind of rest and read. But it's just not the same as it used to be. And not that I wish I had to get dressed up. I'm glad that we get to dress casual, but it is kind of very different than it used to be. So anyway, we're going to be talking with Ed Rush, who is a pilot for the Ford Tri-Motor, and he's one of the guys that brings it around the country tell you about what the early days are like in aviation. It's not what you think. Also, as I mentioned before, so excited to have this person on our podcast. She's an Academy Award nominated actress. She's got a new movie that came out. She just returned to the acting game called The Lovers. Deborah Winger, welcome to Travel with Hawkeye.
Get out of here. I got to call you Hawkeye? Is that what it's going to be? Hi, Hawkeye. All right, let's get it over with. How'd you get the name?
You have already not disappointed. I'm so glad I have that Deborah Winger kind of flair right at the beginning. There's a Hollywood version and there's a real version. What would you like? I can give you both.
Definitely the real version.
I work in radio, and someone thought that would be a good radio name back in my early days, and it just stuck.
Excellent story. Thank you.
Thank you
for not giving me the Hollywood version.
That's why I came up with a Hollywood version, because the story's not so great. But
they never are.
Well, Deborah, I'm so excited about your movie called The Lovers. I read an article about it in Time magazine last week. It's an interesting kind of love story / romantic comedy, but there's a twist to it. Explain the plot.
Oh, I would never do that, Hawkeye. You ought to know better than ask me that. That's just a big spoiler question.
Well, it's out there. It's out there. I mean, it's about two.
Oh, I know. It's a story of two people who fell in love and, you know, did all those things that two people in love do, make a life together, maybe cash in a couple of dreams for a little security, have a kid, look for a great school and a place to live for that kid, get a job, have some money, and lo and behold, it's 25 years later, and they look over and, what the hell? So, and they found themselves a little bit down the road with two other people that are not each other, that are lighting them up. And so that's what the story is.
You know, I love that article in Time magazine, because you've been married 20-plus years now, approximately?
I have.
Okay, and they kind of asked you about marriage advice, and I love the advice you gave them. Like, hey, I'm not giving you any marriage advice.
Yeah, I'm still trying to find out, you know, what it is. I think that's the key, is if you stay interested, you know, you don't know anything 50 years into it that you didn't know the day you fell in love with the person, because you're still trying to find out. If you think you know, you're cooked.
Well, you know, the only advice my dad ever gave me about being married is marriage is like a job. It takes a lot of work. And I thought, well, as a single person, I thought, why would I want a job if I won the lottery? That's what I thought single life was like. But you know what? It is definitely, there is definitely work in marriage, and you got to put some time into it to make it pay back.
Yeah, I never liked the term work, because it doesn't feel like work when you pay attention, you know? It's just, if you're not really interested and you're not, like, wanting to pay attention to something, you know how you, like, if you're with somebody that's kind of boring, and then you just, instead of sitting there saying, God, this person is really boring me, you start to get interested in them, and you ask them some questions, it's amazing how that person is suddenly not boring. But it came because you got interested, not because that person changed. So I would say that being with somebody for the long term is about attention rather than work. But that's just, you know, maybe semantics.
You know, we're talking with Deborah Winger here, and you've been known for some of the most iconic roles in movies, including one that around here, and I'm broadcast out of Dallas, my morning show's out of Dallas, Urban Cowboy. Do you realize, like, how big that movie still is here in Texas?
Yes, I do, Hawkeye. Because nobody ever lets me forget.
Oh.
No, I mean, I think that Jim Bridges had his finger on a pulse of something that is timeless, which is, you know, in the terms of filmmaking, it's, you know, in this filmmaking, it was a slice of Americana. He understood this slice of Americana that exists, whether it plays out at Gillies or, you know, with a mechanical bull or in another, you know, we see it over and over, mm-hmm. all the time in music and on television shows. I mean, yeah.
I still love
doing
this.
I'm doing The Ranch on Netflix, and it comes up all the time, you know.
My favorite scene is where you're riding the bull in a very seductive manner, and you could just see John Travolta just getting angrier and angrier as you ride the bull. That is, it's kind of an iconic scene.
Well, that's interesting that you bring that up, because I thought of it. I thought of Jim Bridges a lot when I was making this film, because everything he taught me, I felt I was able to employ once again, which I'm not able to always use it in films. Directors aren't always as secure as Azza. And I would say that scene is about somebody trying to hurt the other person, trying to make them jealous, trying to make them feel something that's similar to what they're feeling inside. It's like, I'm hurting, God darn it, you're going to hurt too, you know? And I would think that we play that out in so many different ways. So if you're running around with somebody else and you suddenly stop and think about the person that's going to be hurting, you know, is different. So in this film, nobody was malicious. Nobody set out to do what Sissy did on the bull to the butt, you know, set out to hurt him. But the result can often be the same, you know.
We're talking about the new film, The Lovers, which comes out this weekend. I want to ask you a few questions about travel, because first of all, I know that you had some time to travel because you took a little hiatus from your acting career. And can you tell me why? You know, what was the impetus for just taking a break mid-career?
Yeah, I didn't take a break, but it's really hard to explain that to people because, you know, I guess if you are in the, quote, public eye and when you're young and you do things that are not as public, then by their standard, you've gone somewhere. But I can account for every one of those years, I promise. I have three beautiful grown children. I taught, you know, a course at a college. I did lots of things. I just didn't find the movies that were telling the stories that I wanted to tell. I wrote a book in 2010. I stayed a bit busy.
So what you're saying is, hey, you have a very full life, and acting is one part of it, and just because you didn't see me on the screen doesn't mean my life was not
complete. Yeah, but if I said that, that's all that would be quoted, so I'm glad you said it.
Okay.
But, you know, I travel a lot, too, and I think that for me, the fact that it opened up the world to me, I was so young when I started, you know, I hadn't been anywhere. Mm-hmm. So that was very cool that I got to, you know, I found a way to travel that felt great, which was working for a nonprofit.
Well,
know.
Let's talk a little bit about that and your travels. And you said you didn't get a chance to travel so much when you were younger. Where are some of the places you went to, some of the experiences that you remember fondly?
Well, when I first started to act in movies, I started to travel the world. And one of the first big trips, you know, that I took was to Morocco and North Africa. So I shot for 5 months on a film called Sheltering Sky, and that really changed my life.
Really? Because it opened your eyes up to things you'd never experienced before?
That's right. And also I felt like I had been so kind of sheltered in a way. I thought, I think sometimes Americans do suffer from this superiority complex that we have, and we get out in the world and, you know, not everything is measured by economics and by, who lives the fanciest. So I found out about the soul of people, really, when I started to travel.
You know, that's my favorite thing about it, traveling, is it changes your perspective on so many things, small things like, hey, why don't we have this in the United States, and major life-changing things like you just described.
Yeah, and I also felt like I was able to see that my stuff, the things I own, were just, that was not where I was at. I mean, it's nice to have them if you want them, but the essence of my happiness did not come from stuff. And I also love to be disoriented. I don't know about you when you're traveling, but I kind of like to not know where I am and just explore a place sort of purely from my senses, rather than a map. Or, you know, I often refer to what my kids, I say, you know, topography has completely changed, because when I was a kid and growing up, we had maps, and you had to look at a map and you had to find where you were on the map. Now you open your phone and you are that blue dot, yeah. And everything else happens around you. And that's a seismic change in the way one looks at things, not particularly a healthy one.
Well, Deborah, our time is limited, and I'm getting the wrap-up from your producer, and I really appreciate, first of all, the time that you spent with us, and I just want you to know what a thrill it was to talk to you today.
Thank you so much, Hawkeye, and now I get to say I talked to Hawkeye today.
And now she's gone. I mean, first of all, that was a huge thrill to talk to Deborah Winger because I've been a fan for years, but I'm also going to pull the curtain back. She actually just, I mean, they literally just hung the phone up on me here because her producer, her handler, actually sent me a text with like 10 seconds left in the interview saying, she needs to go right now. We have another interview. So that's it. And that's the way it works sometimes when you get to talk to someone on a schedule like that. All right. Earlier this week, I got a chance to fly on a Ford Tri-Motor. It was the very first plane in commercial aviation built in the 20s. And Ed Rush is a pilot for EAA, who is one of the folks that's taking this plane around the country for folks to experience what it was like to travel in 1926. Well, explain, first of all, what is EAA?
EAA is the Experimental Aircraft Association, but it's much broader than its name. We have, of course, experimental aircraft, which we promote, home-built aircraft, new designs and such, which bring about a lot of advances in actual aircraft technology. And then we have a section that handles warbirds. We have a lot of members in the EAA Warbird group. They are all over the country. We have antique and classic section. I'm a member of the antique and classic section, and I'm also a lifetime member of EAA. So we're very, very broad, and we're worldwide. We're the largest aviation organization in the world, and we promote general aviation. We try very, very hard to bring the public as much knowledge as we can about general aviation and to promote it through any of the facets of our organization.
Now, you're one of the pilots that gets to fly the Ford Tri-Motor, and this plane is sometimes known as the Tin Goose. Is that correct?
Yes. The Tin Goose was a name that was given to the Ford Tri-Motor generically by media back in the day. The reason it was called the Tin Goose was it's the first all-metal airliner built in the United States of America. Consequently, Tin Goose.
Okay, and this plane was constructed in 1925. That's when it began its introduction. Is that correct? 1925, 1926, I guess, in that area?
26. The first one was built in 26. The last was built in 1932, and there were 199 of them built total of two models.
Okay, and this, correct me if I'm wrong, this plane right here was the beginning of commercial passenger aviation, is that correct?
The Ford Tri-Motor was not the beginning of commercial passenger aviation, but it was the beginning of reliable commercial passenger aviation.
Okay, and that's a very big difference, is it not? Explain the difference between reliable commercial aviation and what really was going on before this plane was introduced.
There were earlier airliners built here in the United States. The Fokker organization built a tri-motor aircraft, which looked somewhat similar to the Tin Goose, the Ford tri-motor. There were other airliners, the Curtiss Condor, which was a large biplane airliner. Airliners such as that, they did not have the structural and mechanical reliability that the Ford tri-motor brought. The Ford Tri-Motor incorporated several design factors which were very, very much ahead of their time. The first was the all-metal construction, which had been initiated by Hugo Junkers in Germany shortly after World War I. His aircraft proved to be practically indestructible. And when William Stout, who was Henry Ford's chief designer, became a friend of Hugo Junkers, he adopted the Junkers-style all-metal construction. And the Fokker tri-motor, which was not as reliable and which had structural problems, was also a viable configuration for an airplane. So William Stout took the Fokker configuration and the Junkers style of of design and manufacture and construction, and combined the two and came up with an absolute winner, which was a quantum leap ahead of its time in airliners.
Now, before you say this was the first all-metal one, were they made of a combination of metal, wood, and canvas? Would I be correct in saying that's what airplanes were made of before this Ford Trimotor?
That's correct, yes. The Fokker Trimotor was a welded steel tube covered with what we call fabric. It wasn't actually canvas. Mm-hmm. It was a cotton material. And the wings were made, the entire wing structure was made of wood, and therein lay the problem with the Fokker airplane, because the wing structure would rot, and the wings would become weak, and there were crashes of those airplanes because of the structural problems.
Now, when the Ford Trimotor was built, was it built specifically for passengers and passenger travel, or was it built for cargo, or just built to make a durable plane?
Its first configuration was for passengers. Henry Ford, his outfit, the Stout Metal Airplane Company, division of Ford Motor Company, initiated their designs, and they came up with a very successful single-engine design, the Model 2AT. Henry Ford liked that, and he used the 2ATs to haul parts for his car company between Detroit and Chicago and Cleveland. Henry went to his chief designer, Bill Stout, and he said, "I want a passenger airplane now, but I don't want my passengers riding around in a single-engine airplane."
Mm-hmm.
Consequently, Bill Stout went to the Trimotor design, which was already a proven design and was very prevalent in those days, and he came up with a real winner.
Now, when you say the Trimotor, it has three propellers on it, and was that for speed or is that for safety, the three motors?
Well, describing a Ford Trimotor with any type of speed is hard to do because
okay.
They're not very fast.
Okay.
With three engines, the reliability factor was greatly enhanced, and the airplane flies very, very well with any one engine out of commission.
I see. And when you say it wasn't very fast, how fast was it?
Well, the book about the Ford Trimotor will tell you that it cruises at over 100 miles per hour, but I think the book is very optimistic. I've been flying Ford Trimotors since the 70s, and they cruise at right around 90 miles per hour.
Okay. But still a quantum leap over other forms of travel at the time. I don't know what a train would travel at that period of time in the 20s. But would you say it was an advancement, at least in speed?
Oh, absolutely. If you figure that if you got in your Model T back in that day in 1926 and 27, and you went from city to city, you were very lucky because of the roads and the car itself to do about 10 miles per hour. If you got in a Ford Trimotor and went in a straight line from point A to point B at 90 miles per hour, that was light speed in those days.
Yeah. Okay, so we now have the Ford Trimotor. We have it outfitted for passenger traffic. How many people did it sit, not excluding the pilot, and if there were any type of flight crew?
Well, there was usually two pilots on the airplane in airline operation, and the aircraft held about 10 passengers in the back. And there was also a flight attendant who handed out box lunches and cotton for your ears because the aircraft was pretty loud. And she also, of course, assisted if folks, you know, came down with a bit of the air sickness and such. So they were not called flight attendants in those days. They were stewards and stewardesses, mostly stewardesses. And they were required at that time to be registered nurses.
Oh, wow. Okay, so we now have the Ford Trimotor. It's outfitted for 10 passengers. We built this plane. Now, how do we get from that plane to the early days of commercial air traffic, like airports and, you know, terminals and schedules? Was it a smooth transition? How did that all start?
Well, it was smooth in a way, but it was slow to grow. The first paved runway in the United States was Henry Ford's actual airport in Dearborn, Michigan.
Okay.
That was the very first paved runway. All the other airports where the airplanes served at that time were either dirt or grass. And The airline system evolved very, very slowly. The particular one that comes to mind is the Transcontinental Air Transport Service, which started in 1929. And that was a service which took passengers from New York City to L.A. in 48 hours. Now, on a train in those days, that was a four-day trip. With a combination of train and airplane, they cut it down to two. And the way they did that was passengers would embark in New York in the evening. They'd ride all night on a sleeper train to Columbus, Ohio. They would get on a Ford Tri-Motor in the morning in Columbus, and they would ride all day, gas stop to gas stop to gas stop, until evening, and they would get back on a train. They would ride all night once again on a sleeper train. The next morning, they would get back on a Ford Tri-Motor and ride gas stop to L.A., and they would make it in 48 hours. It was quite a grueling trip, but it cut the time in half from coast to coast.
It's kind of interesting because, you know, you take it for granted now that if you want to go from L.A. to New York, that's just really a small part of your day. You can do that in a matter of hours. And, you know, like I said, you really do take that for granted these days.
Oh, most definitely, yes. I ride the airlines a lot because I do a lot of specialized flying. And it's nothing for me to get on an airliner in Detroit and go to L.A. or go to San Francisco to do a job and then turn around the next day and come back.
So when you took that trip, the combined rail and plane trip, so you left New York, you went to Columbus, Ohio on train, you got on the plane in Columbus, where did you fly to catch the train next?
Well, I believe it was somewhere around Wichita. My memory fails me there, but I believe it was out in Kansas.
Okay. And Kansas is a big spot for Boeing now. So, I mean, that's very, you know, that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so that does make a lot of sense there. Now, how long was this Ford Tri-Motor in use before other planes surpassed it?
Well, actually, not very long. The last one was built in 1932. In 1933, the Boeing 247 came along, which was another quantum leap in design. It was a low-wing twin-engine airplane, which had retractable landing gear, and it was very, very much advanced. It had controllable propellers, and it was a very advanced airplane. And then right after that, in 1934, came along the Douglas DC-2, which surpassed the Boeing airplane rapidly. And then in 1935 came along the DC-3, which is still flying today, a lot of them flying today. So air traffic and design moved very rapidly ahead in those years.
Yeah, what was the first plane to be able to go all the way from New York to L.A.?
Well, I'm going to take a wild guess and say it was probably the DC-7 or the Connie.
Uh-huh.
It may well have been the 707. That part I don't remember. But when we got into the late 40s and 50s, where the Douglas designs, which culminated in the DC-7 and then the DC-8 jet, when they came along, they were very advanced. And then of course the Lockheed Constellations were much advanced also, and they had an extremely long range.
And this plane was also used, even though you said it was very briefly, you know, because it was surpassed pretty quickly, it was also used for the first international flight from Key West, Florida to Havana, Cuba. Is that not correct?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So now we look at this plane now, and it's restored. But even that is an interesting story because this plane went through many, many different hands, and it was restored and brought back to its original splendor, was it not?
Oh, yes, definitely. And, you know, I'll add something about this particular airplane. This airplane, and I had mentioned the Transcontinental Air Transport Service coast to coast. This was one of the very airplanes which departed Columbus, Ohio on the very first day of the service.
Oh, wow.
There were two of those that departed that day. The original names on the airplane were City of Columbus, and this is the second one to depart. And this was originally the city of Wichita.
Okay. Wow. So the plane eventually was decommissioned as a passenger vehicle, and then it passed through the hands of private hands. Is that correct? And was restored.
This airplane was in South America and Mexico for quite a time. A lot of the Ford Trimotors gravitated down into that area because they were so rugged and able to fly in and out of short fields that they were ideal for the undeveloped countries down through there. And this airplane's last stop south of the border was in Mexico. It was there for quite a number of years. It was purchased by Bill Hara of Hara's Museum in Reno in the 60s, and brought back into the States. The airplane was completely disassembled and rebuilt back to its actually better than its original condition. It stayed with Bill Hara's museum there for about 20 years, and then it was sold a couple of times, and it ended up in the Evergreen Museum in McMinnville, Oregon. It was there for about 20 years. It flew off and on for about the first 10. And then when Mr. Smith, the owner, no longer flew, the airplane sat in the museum for about 10 years. I was privileged 3 years ago to go out with the crew and install all fresh engines and make the airplane airworthy again. And then three of us flew it from McMinnville, Oregon, back to its home in Ohio now.
And now, Ed, you fly this all over America now, taking it on tours. You stopped in this town, and I got the opportunity also. So you're flying it all over. What's the reaction you get when you come into town with this plane from the 30s or from the 20s, the Ford Trimotor?
Oh, very, very positive. The kids all walk around it and say ooh and ah, and
adults do too, by the way.
Yeah, they're. Well, the adults do that, too, and then we've got the geezers, and I'm rapidly approaching that point, and the geezers come around, and they say, yeah, I remember when Barney Marks landed his out in the 1930s in Joe's backfield out there, you know, and it's just so wonderful to hear the stories from the older folks.
Well, it's just a fascinating story also, and the restoration of it is a neat story, and just the early days of aviation. I really appreciate you taking a few moments to, one, share it with us, and secondly, give me the opportunity to experience it myself.
Well, I'll tell you what, you're going to enjoy it, and you've got one of our finest pilots coming there. I guess Bill Sleeper is going to fly that tour stop. My next tour stop with the airplane is out in Nebraska at Omaha, I believe. And that's next month sometime. But we have 14 pilots, and all of whom are just fabulous pilots. But I flew a Ford before any of them did, so that's my claim to fame.
And one last question. Why did Henry Ford get out of the plane business?
Well, for two reasons. First of all, this was 1932, the depths of the Depression. Henry's automobile business was on its knees. And the airplane business was losing money very, very rapidly. And then a great friend of Henry's by the name of Harry Brooks was the Ford chief test pilot. And he was killed in an experimental Ford airplane, which crashed down in the southeast. I believe it was North Carolina. And Henry just said, we're done, and shut it down. But it wasn't the end of Ford in aviation. Ford built under license 11,600 B-24 bombers during World War II. They built them at a huge plant in Michigan, at Ypsilanti, Michigan, but they were not under the Ford name. They were a consolidated aircraft design, but Ford built 11,600 of them.
Well, Ed, it's a fascinating story, and appreciate, again, the opportunity to talk to you about the early days of aviation and also the early days of passenger air travel, and also appreciate the opportunity to fly in the Trimotor. And thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I have a pleasure trying to relate this history. I love the history, and I love to work with it with the people. So good luck, and Bill Sleeper will just fascinate you with his tall tales and a ride in the Ford Trimotor.
By the way, I'd like to encourage you to go to our website, travelwithhawkeye.com. Click on blog. I've got photos and videos and all sorts of stuff about the Ford Trimotor, so you can check it out and see what it was like to travel back in 1926. So special thanks to Deborah Winger, who joined us today, and Ed Rush from EAA, bringing along the Ford Tri-Motor. And thank you for making us part of your podcast experience. Go out, explore the world, and remember, your adventure awaits. I'm Mark Hawkeye Lewis, and you've been listening to Travel with Hawkeye.